An American reporter from Long Island, New York, was among the reported 13 casualties after the Syrian shelling of the town of Homs today. French President Nicolas Sarkozy's response, "That's enough now. The regime must go." But how? U.S. military officials say the U.S. has already been using drones to monitor the government's crackdown, but will the U.S. use drones in a military role? We're going to take a look at drones today, now called the essential weapon in the U.S. It's not known how many the secretive CIA has, but a decade ago, the military had under 100 drones. Now the military has 7,000. More than 1,000 military pilots control them over countries like Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, with joysticks from bases here in this country. The CIA, of course, has used them to kill militants in Pakistan and Yemen, where we remember the CIA drone strike that killed the American-born radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki last year. Some critics say these drone attacks are illegal. Some worry about the impact on the people who run the drones, some of whom are suffering PTSD and what the military is calling an existential conflict. And then there are questions about whether drones can be used against the U.S. So let's take a look today with Linda Bilmes, senior lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, co-author of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. She joins us in the studio. Linda, welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Farah Stockman, columnist and editorial writer for the Boston Globe, in the studio as well. Farah, welcome too as well.
Thanks for having me.
And you have some fascinating research that you looked at, the impact of flying these drones on some of the pilots. So I want to get to that. But Linda, first of all, how powerful are they? You know, what can they do?
Well, I think that they can do all kinds of things, but what's important about them is that they can do it without a pilot in the cockpit.
Sure.
And throughout history, one of the main deterrents to war is the fact that when you have the potential for your troops to be harmed, you think twice about sending them into harm's way. But today, for the first time, we have unmanned, robotically controlled vehicles where from New Mexico, we can actually track potential enemies, we can perform surveillance, and we can attack potential enemies on the ground.
Well, you know, they can provide ground troops with real-time video for hours on end, and they do this. They run these for hours on end, listen in on cell phone conversations, smell the air for chemicals. But as you said, they can also fire missiles on targets, and you can be launching that missile 1 minute in New Mexico and then go home and have dinner with your family. Completely different psychology of war. And we do want to get to that. But how quick a shift in the military is this? Either of you pick this up. I mean, I read the Air Force top commander say it's equivalent to the introduction of the steamship or the aircraft to warfare. It's that big, Farah.
Yeah. I mean, the history of drones shows that they've been around for a while. In World War II, the Germans used the first weaponized unmanned aerial vehicle. It was huge. It dropped a 2,000-pound bomb. The Israelis used drones during the Lebanon War, and it wasn't until the first Gulf War that the United States started pilot programming these things. And we actually created something that used an engine, a snowmobile engine that was so loud, the Iraqi Republican Guard would hear it and it would just strike fear in their hearts. The Iraqi Republican Guard was the first group to actually surrender to a drone. And since that time, we have really ramped up our production of these things, and it has become a total sea change because now we are buying more unmanned aerial vehicles than planes with pilots.
And Farah, just briefly on the why. I mean, we know it's less expensive, as Linda was saying. It doesn't put troops in harm's way on the ground. But you've heard murmurings, Farah Stockman, that the increased use of drones in the Obama administration may be a reaction to the difficulty over trying people. I mean, is it really the thinking of if we can't bring them back and try them and they would only be stuck at Guantanamo, why not target them?
Well, just think of how the outcry over Guantanamo. Think of the all the lawyers and all the expenses and all the moral questions that the American public have been debating for the last 10 years. I have heard conversations in Washington of people who've said, well, if it's going to be this much trouble, this much hassle, maybe we shouldn't capture them alive. Does anybody doubt that we couldn't have taken Osama bin Laden alive?
Yeah. Well, as Peter Singer, who's been on the program talking about drones, and we'll link you to that at hereandnow.org, as he says, but just because it's new technology don't think you don't still have the same ethical questions about war. And Linda, just start with some of the questions that are being asked, the legality, the ethics of using drones.
Well, I think that there are a number of questions, legal, moral, ethical, security questions, accountability questions. One of the most important questions is the fact that unlike in previous conflicts, we now have essentially two chains of command. We have two drone programs. We have a conventional one run by the military, and we have a covert one run by the CIA. And with the CIA program, it is unclear who is accountable. In traditional warfare, the military is in charge, and we can see the budget, and there is at least a transparent system for declaring war and choosing and selecting targets. But now you have a CIA-run program that does not report to the military command and that has a secret budget, and where it is entirely unclear how targets are selected and how the program is administered. And this accountability program, in my opinion, is going to get much worse as the technology develops to the next stage with intelligent robotic drones that make decisions on their own.
Well, and just to staying with the current questions, we read that the drone that came down in Iran back in December was a CIA operation, but it was the military was involved in it, so there's murkiness there. And also, it may have been Iran figuring out a way. It may not have crashed. Iran may have brought it down.
Well, the CIA stealth drone that came down in Iran in December is a very mysterious case. Iran claimed that it hacked into the controls and brought it down. The CIA said it crashed. But in any event, the drone was completely intact, and Iranian scientists were able to show it to the Russians and to the Chinese and to parade it on TV. And then, of course, President Obama famously asked Iran to return it, and Iran, thumbing its nose at the U.S., returned a tiny pink toy drone. But this fiasco shows the problem about the lack of security and transparency about the program and the mission.
We're talking about the use of drones in warfare, something that's increased dramatically over just the last 10 years. We're talking with Linda Bilmes, senior lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Farah Stockman, columnist and editorial writer for the Boston Globe. And Farah, I want to start with you and talk about the people manning, and in some cases there are women who are piloting these drones from here in the U.S., questions about whether they really are pilots, and questions about the impact of the work they do. You reported on a psychological study the military's done of its RPA pilots. These are the remotely piloted aircraft pilots. What did that study show?
Well, it was a remarkable study that showed that half of them had high levels of stress, and 4% of them had symptoms similar to PTSD, which is much lower than pilots who actually go into combat, but it's still higher than you would expect for people who are sitting in Nevada who are in no personal danger to themselves. And so it was really the first attempt by the military to figure out what's stressing these pilots out and what is the mental impact of this kind of war without danger on human beings, on the human brain.
The questions you ask out of this study are these feelings one day going to be seen as a new mental disorder growing out of a new kind of warfare? But you also quote a psychologist, Paula Kaplan, who says, no, this is not a disorder at all. PTSD is not a disorder. It's war that is the problem. People are having a normal reaction to it. But staying with these pilots, because there's a big debate in the Air Force as to whether or not they really are pilots. You know, there's a hierarchy in the Air Force, and there's some resentment of what's called these, Xbox jockeys, having anywhere close to the experience that a pilot flying over a country dropping a bomb might have.
Right. I mean, no little boy ever dreamed of growing up and being a drone pilot, right? For a long time, this is a very machismo culture, and a lot of these guys really wanted to be out there in the field of battle. So the Air Force was very resistant at first to having classes of drone pilots who didn't go through all the training that it took to fly a real plane. And now we have that because the appetite for these drones is so high that these guys are working so much. They have to man these drones 24 hours a day.
And they can't train them fast enough.
So so now you're having people who are specifically being trained in an 8-month program specifically for drones, and they have a special pin that they wear that has a thunderbolt, which is different than the other Air Force pilots.
Well, that comes out of stories like the one we read about the jet pilot who dropped the bomb on al-Qaeda leader al-Zarqawi in 2006. He won a Distinguished Flying Cross, but the pilots of the Predator drone that helped him find Zarqawi just got a thank you note. There's this tension within the Air Force as to, you know, just who is a pilot. Linda, this goes to some of your thinking, which is that there's just it's so new, and it's almost like the technology is happening before the planning for it.
That's right. We're in an entirely new era of unmanned robotics that has developed in the last 5 or 10 years very quickly, an era in which it's very much easier to attack, an era in which we are very vulnerable to being hacked, in which it's the technology will be copied and proliferated, and in which there is a lack of clear lines of accountability. And I think that we need to recognize that this is a new era. The genie is out of the bottle, and we need to develop an international code of conduct for unmanned warfare. And if we don't get out in front of this and start trying to develop an international code now, I think that the specter of science fiction type drone wars is I'm afraid, all too real.
Well, and, you know, a horrible thing to think about. And yet, do the supporters of the drone, I'm imagining they constantly point out, it's still less than the number of troops that are killed in traditional ground warfare.
Well, as I said in many forums, the lack of risk makes it easier to launch wars, makes it easier to make mistakes, and we need to recognize that the appeal of drones, which are cheaper and lower risk to our troops, makes it more likely, not less likely, that mistakes will happen.
Yeah, it's Farah.
I think one of the appeals of drones is that it's like the opposite of counterinsurgency warfare. It's the opposite of having a huge footprint, going in there.
Winning hearts and minds?
Exactly,
yeah.
Winning hearts and minds. You just go in there and get the bad guy. But I don't think we're always getting who we think we're getting. I think for every bad guy you kill in the tribal areas of Pakistan, you have to remember that maybe you're creating 10 more. And so I think we have to think twice about this being a panacea for war, of replacing war.
Well, and it, as you've been saying, it opens up a whole new field of psychological study. The pilots that man these drones. And by the way, I think 16% of the recent graduating class were women, so that raises questions. Does that mean that women are in combat if they're manning a drone? But, they suffer not just the stress of just hours and hours on essentially a video game, but then it suddenly gets serious, and they are watching real time, seeing the people that they kill. What is an existential conflict is what one of the military psychiatrists told you that was.
Right. These drones have cameras that can see, that can read a license plate from 2 miles away. And so they can see up close the people they kill. There have been instances of drones that have mistakenly attacked Afghan civilians. There have been cases of drones that have mistakenly killed American soldiers. And so I think that is what's driving this quote-unquote existential conflict. Some of these pilots experience nagging questions of whether they're doing the right thing, whether it's right to be sitting in Nevada or New Mexico pushing a button and killing someone who is not a threat to them.
So we're at the frontier of something very new, very different. Just a few seconds left, Linda. You say the call is for, some sort of international statement as to how to proceed. Do you think that that's the inevitable outcome here? It will proceed.
Well, it will proceed. Right now, we may have the most advanced drone technology, but there are 50 countries who already have drones or are developing them. And what happens if our enemies produce ones that even are not as good as ours, but they produce 2 or 3 times as many?
Yeah.
We must plan ahead for this.
Linda Bilmes, again, senior lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, also author of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, and Farah Stockman, columnist and editorial writer for the Boston Globe, helping us take a closer look at the impact of the use of drones by the U.S. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.